Our next speaker is Dr. Paul Fronston. He's the Director of Health Research and Education Program of the Employee Benefit Research Institute. This institute's a private, nonpartisan organization in Washington, D.C., committed to research and education on economic security and employee benefits. All three of his degrees are in economics. He's published 112 papers. He's edited three books, two of which are on consumer health savings accounts. He's testified before Congress 10 times. He's made 108 presentations across the country. He serves on the subcommittee of the status of the uninsured for the Institute of Medicine of the National Academies and on the Maryland State Planning Grant Healthcare Coverage Work Group. So Dr. Fronson's topic today is the potential impact of consumer health savings accounts as a market-based approach for improving quality and reducing costs. Welcome, Dr. Fronston.
Thank you. One thing that I think is important to know is something about the Employee Benefit Research Institute, where I work. We're a nonpartisan organization. We don't take positions on policy. You may not think that's true after you hear some of my comments about health savings accounts, but I think it's also important to keep in mind where we get our funding from. We get funding from lots of different types of organizations that are interested in economic security and employee benefits. Many of those organizations either provide HSAs to their employees, are about to provide them to their employees, or sell them in the market, or lots of insurance companies too. And our members that fund us, a lot of times they don't like what we say, but they certainly appreciate our honesty and our opinion. It helps them in the marketplace. I was asked to spend a few moments talking about health savings accounts and what they are. I'll give you a brief overview. I view this presentation not just about health savings accounts, but about account-based health plans in general, because there are more than one type of account that you can associate with a health plan. Health savings accounts are unique, though. They're unique because they're the only personal account that an individual could use to put money in on a tax-free basis, let it accumulate on a tax-free basis, and then take it out on a tax-free basis, as long as when you take the money out, you use it for a qualified medical expense. You could also use it to pay COBRA premiums if you're unemployed. You could use it to pay for long-term care insurance premiums. And you could use it to pay for retiree health premiums if you are covered by Medicare. In order to make a contribution to a health savings account, you need to be on a high deductible plan. These numbers for the deductibles are for 2004. I think they're $50 higher this year. In terms of the contributions, they are limited to either the lesser of the deductible level or $2,650. So for an individual, if you had a $1,000 deductible, you could only put $1,000 in. If you had a $3,000 deductible, you could only put $2,650 in. You couldn't put more than your deductible in, and it's capped at the $2,650. Keep in mind, in terms of distributions from the account, you could take distributions at any time. You do not have to have a high deductible plan in order to withdraw money from the account. You only need to have a high deductible plan to put money into your account. And once you reach age 55, catch-up contributions are allowed. And by 2009, you'll be able to put in an additional $1,000 each year above the amount that other people are allowed to put in. The other type of account I want to bring to your attention is known as a health reimbursement arrangement. These have been around, I guess, the better part of 4 years now. Some would even say they've been offering them even longer. They're typically notional accounts. They're provided by employers, and they're associated with high-deductible health plans. Employee contributions are not permitted. It's strictly employer money that goes into the account, but it's really just a bookkeeping feature. Employers don't actually put money into the account. And I'll speak a little bit more about that in a minute. The way it works is that you could think of this as simply a high deductible health plan. I typically use the example of a $2,000 deductible, and an employer puts $1,000 in the account. You have the personal account, which would be up to $1,000. That's that line between personal account and deductible gap. The deductible gap is another $1,000. So that's the gap between the amount of money that an employer would put in the account and the deductible level. And once you reach that deductible gap, which would be $2,000, comprehensive insurance kicks in. I mentioned already that the account is funded by employer funds only. It only exists on paper. Like an HSA, balances can roll over from year to year. So if you don't use up what's in the account, you could add it to your next year's account. Employers don't have to let you do that. It's completely up to the employer to design this the way that they want to. Employers also control the exit rules on the account. They could allow an employee to have access to the money in the account after he or she leaves their job. They don't have to, but they can allow that. That's just some of the highlights, and some of the differences between HSAs and HRAs I think are important to understand. First, when it comes to ownership of the account, under an HRA, the employer owns the account, not the employee. The employer decides if the employee could take the money with the employee after he or she leaves the job. On the HSA, the employee owns the account. Once an employer puts money in an HSA, it's the employee's money. Both funds, both types of accounts allow you to roll over the funds each year. I already mentioned about access to the account upon job separation. When it comes to who contributes, only the employer can contribute to an HRA, but both the employer and the employee can contribute to an HSA. The HRA does not have to be combined with a high deductible health plan, but usually is. The HSA does need to be combined with one. They both can be used with other accounts. I don't know if you're familiar with flexible spending accounts, but that's something you could have in addition to having an HRA or an HSA, and there's lots of rules about how the two interact. In both cases, the money in the accounts can be used for non-medical expenses, but there are penalties and taxes associated with that. And in both cases, the money put in the account is given a tax preference. There was a survey done back in, I guess it was last year, March of last year, of about 1,000 large employers asking them, what's your interest in HSAs? Are you going to offer these to your employees? And a handful said that they were very likely to by 2005, 8%. Another 35% said they were somewhat likely to. Really, enrollment, there's going to be a lot of offerings of HSAs in the large group market next year. By the time the guidance came out in July, and keep in mind that this survey was fielded even before the guidance came out from Treasury, it was too late for most employers to add this plan, too late for most large employers to add this plan as one of the options for January of this year. So most employers are thinking about doing it for 06. I'm often asked, I get calls from reporters all the time asking, how many people are in HSAs? How fast is it going to grow? Can we say that because it's such a small number that HSAs have been a failure? Well, they've only been around a year. It's too soon to draw that conclusion. But in terms of predicting what the take-up is going to look like, I think it's going to look like a lot like the way managed care evolved. Back in the late 80s, very few people were in managed care plans. We got our first PPO around 1987. And then by 1992, I think more than half the population was in a managed care plan. Today, more than half the population's in a PPO. And over 90% of the population's in a managed care plan. So maybe it's going to be 10 or 15 years that we might see a significant number of people in HSAs. It may happen sooner than that because of desperation among employers to do something about rising health care costs. There's strong interest now. Interest may wane as employers think about some of the issues related to moving employees to HSAs and account-based plans generally. We may find that large employers prefer health reimbursement arrangements over HSAs, because under a health reimbursement arrangement, you don't have to put money into the account until someone uses health care. There's no expenditure until someone uses healthcare. Whereas with an HSA, if you're going to fund the account as an employer, you're putting money into everybody's account at the same time, whether or not they use any healthcare at all. And employers are very hesitant to give healthy employees money for healthcare when they're not going to need it for healthcare. You know, Scott showed the slide before that I think it was 15% of the population and I have a similar slide I'll show you in a minute, 50% of the population use no health care. Employers don't want to give them money if they're not going to use health care. So employers may prefer HRAs over HSAs. And I think one of the things that's telling in that same survey of large employers, they were asked, are you going to fund the account? If you offer an HSA, will you fund the account? And about 40%, 39% said they had no intentions whatsoever of funding the account. They saw the benefit of an HSA simply as it wasn't the HSA, it was the ability to offer a high deductible health plan at a lower premium that would save them money and allow employees to go out and open an HSA if they wanted to. In terms of employee take-up, certainly where employers do full replacement, as some large employers have, there'll be high take-up, but some employees may opt out and get coverage elsewhere or go uninsured. And ultimately, take-up's going to depend upon a number of variables, premiums, employer education efforts, the wages of employees, and the health status of employees as well. In terms of the small group market, we may actually see greater growth in a small group market, at least initially, than we do in a large group market. And I'm hearing from a number of my members that tell me they can't keep up with enrollment right now in HSAs in a small group. It's just overwhelming the amount of time they're spending enrolling employees. But small employers are also slower to change health benefits generally. We did a survey a couple of years ago in 2003, and this was after 3 years of double-digit premium increases for small employers. We found that only 19% of these employers that we interviewed had changed their health benefits, even though they had 3 years of double-digit increases. And we asked them, you know, why do you offer benefits? And they told us that it has a positive impact on recruitment and retention. It has a positive impact on productivity, the overall success of the business. It's the most valued employee benefit by workers. 43% of these same employers told us that they cut back in other ways in response to rising health benefit costs. They sometimes had to lay people off, or they had hiring freezes or wage freezes or compensation cuts and other employee benefit cuts. They put off capital and equipment purchases. There's a real cost to rising health benefits. But what we found was that employers, especially small employers, will do anything they can to maintain the health benefits because it's so highly valued by the employee and because they think it has such a strong impact on the business that they'll make other trade-offs. So as long as employers, if they think that adopting an HSA will have a negative impact on their business, they won't. They'll stick with what they have as long as they possibly can. I'm going to skip this slide in the interest of time. In terms of the public sector, we already know the Federal Employees Program has been offering HRA plans, consumer-driven health plans, since 2003, and this year introduced eight plans, with two of them on a national basis, so six of them on a regional basis. And there are some local governments that are already offering these plans. And just keep in mind, as Scott already said, the public sector is subject to the same cost pressures as the private sector, especially for their employees. There are a number of obstacles which may prevent HSAs from being adopted by the public sector as fast as they'll be adopted by the private sector. The public sector already lags behind the private sector in terms of its use of managed care. The public sector is more likely subject to unionization and collective bargaining agreements, which makes it more difficult to change health benefits generally. And the public sector has been less likely than the private sector to use high deductible health plans. So it's based upon what we already know about the public sector lagging behind the private sector. Wouldn't be surprised if HSAs lag there as well. In terms of employee reaction, I think it's important to understand how these plans work and how it may affect the way employees view the plans. I think the plans, HSA plans specifically, will be more attractive to individuals than they will be to families. And that's because you have an individual deductible versus a family deductible. You can't have two $1,000 deductibles for a married couple. You have to have one $2,000 deductible. And many families will view that as penalizing them if they have one unhealthy person. Okay, if me and my wife each had a $1,000 deductible, as soon as one of us reached that deductible, insurance would kick in for us. Okay, but chances are we're not both unhealthy, which means if we have a $2,000 deductible and one of us uses a lot of healthcare expenses, it would be $2,000 that we'd have to spend between the two of us before insurance kicks in, and that would take longer, and that would be unattractive to many families. I think that would be even more unattractive to single parents, given how little most children spend when it comes to health care. I think there'll also be some confusion regarding these plans. Remember the old term, usual, customary, and reasonable? I don't know, you know, it's sort of dropped. We dropped the use of this term for a long time. This is the way insurance works. Insurance reimburses based upon average charges. So if an insurance company says that the average charge of going to a doctor in your area is $100, and that doctor charges you $200 or something above $100, then even though you spent $200 to go to the doctor and the money came out of the account, only $100 will be applied towards the deductible. So it will take you that much longer to reach the deductible. Let me skip the rest of that slide in the interest of time. Annual claims distribution. This is essentially the same slide that Scott showed you. Shows that 20% of the population accounts for 80% of the spending. Also shows you all the way to your left that a large percentage of the population uses very few healthcare services. And it's important to keep this in mind when you're thinking about how health savings accounts will impact overall spending. Also important to keep in mind that 15 conditions account for over 50% of the spending. So unless health savings accounts and high deductible plans generally are able to have an impact on things like heart disease and cancer, mental disorders, diabetes, arthritis, unless it's able to have an impact on these things, it's unlikely to have an impact overall on healthcare spending. And the things not on this chart all account for less than 1% of spending. I think the potential for controlling costs is very limited. We know that very high users of healthcare services are not don't do a very good job of managing their health and controlling their costs, and they must be able to do that in order for us to have see healthcare costs be significantly affected. There's also the issue of the fact that since healthcare costs are so highly concentrated among a small percentage of the population, even if you gave them a high deductible plan and an HSA, they really have no incentive to control their costs. If they know they're going to spend $5,000 a year or more, what difference does it make if they're going to, you know, use up all the money in their HSA each and every year? If they change the way they use healthcare services only to try and save money, the only thing that's going to do for them is delay the point at which they reach their deductible. It's not going to make the difference between reaching a deductible or not. And unless they're sensitive to the fact that changing their behavior and choosing certain providers will save their employer money, unless they're sensitive to that, it's not going to have a big impact on their overall use. I think it's also important to keep in mind the Institute of Medicine, I think it was last year, came out with a report which found that about 50% of the adult population is considered health literate. They're health illiterate. And we're essentially asking, we wouldn't ask people to defend themselves in court. You wouldn't want to be your own lawyer. And we're essentially asking people through high deductible plans and HSAs to be their own doctor and to treat themselves. And I think we're potentially making a big mistake. Account-based plans have a risk of inducing demand, especially for the healthy population, and especially in the this is more true in the HRA-based plans than the HSA plans. If an employer is putting money into an account and you can't take that account with you when you leave your job, where are you going to spend the money? And if you're healthy, if you know that you don't spend that much money each year, why not spend $200 on a pair of eyeglasses? Or $150 to go to the doctor for a cough when you otherwise wouldn't. And what happens is we've gone from having a copay of $10 or $20 to go to a doctor to care being free for people who are healthy because the money's coming out of the account that's employer funded. It's not coming out of the employer's pocket anymore. I think the potential savings is small because it's, you know, I already talked about the high cost cases not changing their behavior. So it really means we're going to affect care in the middle of the distribution. You know, Scott showed it as 35%. I'm showing it as 20 to 30%. Whatever it is, people with expenses between $1,000 and $3,000 a year. And if we're able to reduce their expenses by 10%, that's only a 2 to 3% savings overall. And I think that's optimistic at best. There's a risk of long-term induced demand, especially under the HRA plans, more true for HRAs than for HSAs. You take a healthy employee given an HRA, let's use an example of a 35-year-old male. On average, he uses $500 a year out of the $1,000 that's contributed to his HRA. So after 20 years, he has $10,000 in his account. 20 years from now, he's 55, thinking about retiring or changing jobs, not as healthy as he was when he was 35, and we can only imagine the kind of technology that will be available to him 20 years from now and the cost. Well, he's going to figure out how to use the money before he leaves his job, and that's going to induce demand. Okay, I've been given the stop sign. You have copies of the slides. Let me just point out the last few slides, which go over how HSAs can be used to save for money in retirement. The real issue here, I won't go into all the details, is that you're limited in how much you can contribute, $1,000 a year or $2,600 a year, depending upon your deductible. But there's less of a limit when it comes to how much money you'll need, because you don't know how long you're going to live. Okay, so the most you could possibly save, if you put in $2,600 over 10 years, is $44,000. If you live to age 80, you're going to need $140,000 for health care. If you live to age 90, I think it's about $200,000. So the amount you need goes up the longer you live, but the amount you could save in the account is constrained at this $44,000. So I'll end there and look forward to questions. Thank you. Yeah, I'm just
going to put this back. Okay, questions for Dr. Franson. Yes.
As you distinguish between the large employer and the small employer, are your lines drawn where ERISA, the self-insured employers, would be drawn versus other employers that are not part of ERISA or not self-insured?
I'm not exactly sure. Can you expand on your question?
Well, in Wisconsin, Wisconsin has little control over those employers. Kramer's, for example, in Plain, the bridge builders, they self-insure. So if they lay off an employee who's an ill employee and that person is now out there without health care, we call that dumping. And we don't like to see it happen. But the self-insured folks, we have little control over. We can't tell them what to do. So part of what we see in Wisconsin is the potential for, if a person has an HSA, if they buy into long-term care or at least they have something out there, when they're dumped by an employer and lose their position, at least they have some means of caring for themselves and their family that they may not otherwise have.
Well, I think you're going to see the same risks whether it's a large or small employer. And your control over small employers is limited as well because they're covered under ERISA. It's not like you could mandate that they provide insurance coverage. So they could dump as well. But I think your control is limited in the sense that whether it's a large employer or a small employer and employees, you know, for whatever reason, leaving those jobs, if they had HSAs, you have to ask how much money are they going to have in the account at that point. Because, we sort of advertise it as a 401k plan for healthcare. But the key difference between a 401k plan and an HSA is money doesn't just go into the account, but it comes out for everyday health expenses.
That goes to my second question, which is really, have we got any numbers from other states as to what people are purchasing in terms of long-term care? Because that's where I see the real potential for savings. If we could have people or a greater share of the marketplace private paying instead of relying on the government system, that's where the savings would be. If we're going to push this as a retirement plan, I think we lose.
Yeah, I think that's really important to look at. I don't know of any data yet. The plans are just too new. And we don't even have a good sense of how many people are enrolled in these plans. There are some numbers floating out there. But even if they're right, it's 500,000 people, maybe 2 million people as of January 1st. So it's just too soon to know, to answer lots of the questions that are coming up.
Marlon Schneider, Wisconsin Rapids. Who gets these accounts? I mean, I'm looking at your chart here where you got to have $44,000 here and $23,000 there, and it makes certain assumptions. I don't know about you, but at my pay grade, I wouldn't be able to do that.
Well, again, that's showing what the maximum potential you could save over 10 years. If you put $1,000 a year in for 10 years and made your catch-up contributions, where, you know, I had to go over those slides real fast, so that was assuming catch-up contributions were made for a 55-year-old. By the time he or she was eligible for Medicare, they'd have either $23,000 in the account if they put $1,000 each year, or $44,000 in the account if they did the maximum of $2,600. It's also assuming that no money is taken out of the account to pay for health care spending between the ages of 55 and 64, which I think is unreasonable to assume, because those are the years when you're working that you're going to use the most money in the account.
What does your analysis show as to who has these accounts? I mean, is it people in high income brackets? Is it people? What kind of people are the ones who have these accounts today?
Again, we have limited knowledge about that because they've only been around a year, and most people have first signed up for these accounts as of January 1. So most people have only had them for a month. But the initial evidence suggests that to some degree they are higher income people. But at the same time, there's a correlation between income and age, and between age and health status. So it's not just healthy people signing up for these accounts. I think income is a stronger driver than health status in some sense.
Senator Luther Olson, are HSAs driving higher deductible premiums, or are higher deductible premiums driving HSAs? Because I see in my area a lot of companies, small companies, have had to go up to even $4,000 deductibles for families because that's all they can afford. And is this HSA's a response to that, or do you think it's going to drive deductibles even higher?
I was told to make this a quick answer in the interest of time. I think it's all driven by cost, and it's not driven by HSAs. HSAs make it easier to offer a high deductible plan, but ultimately it's the premium that's driving employers to move to high deductible plans. And if they could fund the account, they will. But as you saw, many don't even plan on funding the account. So they're just looking at the high deductibles as a savings vehicle. Okay.